Hi, folks, and welcome to Spider on the Web number 80, your one-stop shop for electrifying science fiction and eclectic music. I will finish reading you my novella, Satan's Children, this time round, as promised. But first, here are my good friends Doug Cox, Salil Bhatt, Ramkumar Mishra, and Nolan's own John Boutet, collectively known as Slide to Freedom, with the title track from an album of theirs that has just been nominated for a Juno Award, Canada's equivalent of the Grammy, Make a Better World. Take it, fellas.
The world we know was built on skills, but that alone, it don't count, no. But after sweat and toils of yours and mine, it would not be worth a dime. You gotta live and give, share and care, really put love in the air. When your neighbor's down, you ought to pick him up. Nobody can live in despair. Everybody let's sing, sing, sing. Everybody let's sing. Let freedom ring. Join hands, do your thing. Make a better world to live in, my Lord. Everybody let's sing, sing, sing. Everybody let's sing. Let freedom ring. Join hands, do your thing. Make a better world to live in. Society has no priority. We're all a part of the whole. Yes. Whenever people shout, you gotta hear them out. Cause everybody got a good, good, beautiful soul. We gotta come together, hand in hand. Really got to do our best. Oh Lord. Now, wouldn't it be a pleasant sight to see the world full of happiness? Everybody let's sing, sing, sing. Everybody let's sing. Let freedom ring. A joint hand, all pitch in. Make a better world to live in.
You can find a direct hot link to that CD at DougCox.org, and while you're there, don't miss Doug's own fabulous new podcast, Roots Review. I'm a subscriber and predict you'll be one too. And now, as promised, here is the second part of Satan's Children, about a holy lunatic's dream of actually making a better world through chemistry. Satan's Children by Spider Robinson, Part 2. Zack and Jill held a hasty war council in the flimsy balcony of their second-floor apartment. It overlooked a yard so small it would have been hard put not to, as Zack loved to say, and offered a splendid view of the enormous oil refining facility across the street. The view of Halifax Harbor, which the architect had planned, was forever hidden now behind it, but the cooling breezes still came at night, salt-scented and rich. Even at 2 a.m. the city was noisy, like a dormitory after lights out, but all the houses on this block were dark and still. "I think we should pack our bags," Zack said, sipping coffee. "And do what?" "The dealers must know that Wesley brought a large amount of truth with him. He intended to turn it over to them for distribution. They don't know where it's stashed, and they must be shitting a brick wondering who else does. We're suspect because we're known to have spoken with him, and a hitching depot is a natural stash, so we don't go near the stuff." "But we've got to." "Yeah, we will. Look, tomorrow we're supposed to go on tour, right?" "Screw the tour." "No, hon, look, this is the smart way. We do just exactly what we would have done if we'd never met Wesley George. We act natural, do the tour as planned, we pack our bags and go down to the hitching depot and take off. But some friend of ours, say John, goes in just ahead of us and scores the bag. Then we show up and ignore him, and by the three of us make up a full car for somebody, and after we're out of the terminal and about to board out of the public eye, John changes his mind and fades, and we take over the bag. Zip-o-bang, off on tour." "I'll say it again, screw the tour. We've got more important things to do."
"Like what?"
"Huh? What do you want to do with the stuff? Call the reporters? Stand on Barrington Street and give away samples? Call the heat? Look, we're proposing to unleash truth on the world. I'm willing to take a crack at that, but I'd like to live to see what happens, so I don't want to be connected with it publicly in any way if I can help it. We keep our cover and do our tour, and we sprinkle fairy dust as we go."
"Dose people, you mean?"
"Dose the most visible people we can find and make damn sure we don't get caught at it, yes. We're supposed to hit 19 cities in 28 days in a random pattern even a computer couldn't figure out. I intend to leave behind us the goddamnedest trail of headlines in history."
"Zack, I don't follow your thinking."
"Okay." He paused, took a deep breath, slowed himself visibly. "Okay. Considering what we've got here, it behooves me to be honest. I have doubts about this. Heavy doubts. The decision we're making is incredibly arrogant. We're talking about destroying the world as we know it."
"To hell with the world as we know it, Zack. It stinks. A world of truth has to be better."
"Okay, in my gut something agrees with you, but I'm still not sure. A world of truth may be better, but the period of turmoil while the old world collapses is sure going to squash a lot of people. Nice people. Good people. Jill, something else in my gut suspects that maybe even good people need lies sometimes. So I want to hedge my bets. I want to experiment first and see what happens. To do that, I have to make another arrogant decision, to dose selected individuals cold-bloodedly and without giving them a chance, let alone a vote. Wesley experimented himself with a lab and volunteers and procedure and tests until he proved to his satisfaction that it was okay to turn this stuff loose. Well, I haven't got any of that, but I have to establish to my satisfaction that it's cool."
"Do you doubt his results?" Jill asked indignantly.
"To my satisfaction, not Wesley's or even yours, my darling, or anyone else's. And yes, frankly, I have some doubts about his results."
Jill clouded up.
"How can you, baby, listen to me? I believe that every word Wesley George said to us was the absolute unbiased truth as he knew it. But he himself had taken the drug. That makes him suspect."
Jill dropped her eyes.
"That retroactive consent business bothered me a little, too."
Zack nodded.
"Yeah, if everybody comes out of a prefrontal lobotomy with a smile on his face, what does that prove? If you kidnapped somebody and put a drought on their head, made them a wirehead, they'd thank you on their way out, but so what? Things like that are like scooping out somebody's self and replacing it with a new one. The new one says thanks, but the old one was murdered. I want to make sure that Homo veritas is a good thing, in the opinion of Homo sapiens. So I propose that neither of us take the drug.
I propose that we abstain and take careful precautions not to accidentally contaminate ourselves while we're using it. We'll dose others, but not ourselves, and then when the tour is over, or sooner if it feels right, we'll sit down and look over what we've done and how it turned out. Then, if we're still agreed, we'll take a couple of hits together and call CBC News. By then, there'll be so much evidence they'll have to believe us, and then the word will be out. Too far out for the dealers to have it squashed or discredited, or the government. And then the world will end. And a new one will begin. But first we've got to know. Am I crazy or does that make sense to you? Jill was silent a long time. Her face got the blank look that meant she was thinking hard. After a few minutes, she got up and began pacing the apartment. It's risky, Zach. Once the headlines start coming, they'll figure out what happened and come after us. Yeah, and the only people who know our schedule are Fat Jack and the agency. We'll tell them there's a skip tracer after us, and they'll both keep shut. But, Jill, this ain't the feds after us. It's a bunch of dealers who dasn't let anybody know they exist. They can't have the resources they need to trace us, even if they didn't know what city we were in. They might. Dealers' union would have to be international. That's a lot of weight, Zach, a lot of money. Darling, if all you got is piss-poor dope. He broke off and shrugged. Jill grinned suddenly. You make cigars. Let's get packed. More coffee? They took little time in packing and preparing their apartment for a long absence. This would be their third tour together. By now it was routine. At last, everything that needed doing was done. The lights were out, save for the bedside lamp, and they were ready for bed. They undressed quickly and silently, with no flirting byplay, and slid under the covers. They snuggled together spoon fashion for a few silent minutes, and then Zach began rubbing her neck and shoulders with his free hand, kneading with guitarist's fingers and lover's knowledge. They had not yet spoken a word of the change that the events of the evening had brought to their relationship, and both knew it, and the tension in the room was thick enough to smell. Zach thought of 100 things to say, and each one sounded stupider than the last. Zach?
Yeah?
We're probably going to die, aren't we?
We're positively going to die.
She stiffened almost imperceptibly under his fingers. But I could have told you that yesterday or last week.
She relaxed again.
Difference is, yesterday I couldn't have told you positively that we'd died together. Zach would have sworn they were inextricably entwined, but somehow she rolled round into his arms in one fluid motion, then pulled him on top of her with another. Their embrace was eight-legged and wholehearted and completely non-sexual, and about a minute of it was all their muscles would tolerate. Then they drew apart just far enough to meet each other's eyes. They shared that, too, for a long minute, and then Zach smiled. Have you ever noticed that there is no position or combination of positions in which we do not fit together like nesting cups? She giggled, and in the middle of the giggle, tears leaked from her laughing eyes. Oh, Zach, she cried and hugged him again. I love you so much.
I know, baby, I know, he murmured in her ear, stroking her hair.
It's not every day that you find something worth dying for, and something worth living for, both at the same time.
Christ, I love you.
They both discovered his rigid erection at the same instant, and an instant later they discovered her sopping wetness, and for the first time in their relationship, their loins joined without manual aid from either of them. Together they sucked air slowly through their teeth, and then he began to pull his head back to meet her eyes, and she stopped him, grabbing his head with her hands and pushing her tongue into his ear. His hips arched reflexively, his hands clutched her shoulders, her legs locked round his, and the oldest dance began again. It was 11 a.m. before they finally slept, and by that time they were in someone else's car, heading, ironically enough, north by northwest. It's the best way out of Halifax. The reader wishing a detailed account of Zach and Jill's activities over the next month can find it at any library with a good news tape and newspaper morgue. The reader is advised to bring a lunch. At any time of the year, the individual stories that the two folk singers sewed behind them like death charges would have been hot copy. But God had ordained that Wesley George drop dead in August, smack in the middle of silly season. The news media of the entire North American Confederation went into grateful, orgasmic convulsions. Not all the stories made the news. The events involving the Reverend Schwartz in Montreal, for instance, were entirely suppressed at the time by the husbands involved, and have only recently come to light.
when militant radical leader Mituzanje, the notorious White Mau Mau, was found in Harlem with bullets from 16 different unregistered guns in him, there was at that time nothing to connect it with the other stories, and it got 3 inches on page 43. Indeed, the most incredible thing in retrospect is that no one, at the time, connected any of the stories. Though each new uproar was dutifully covered in detail, not one journalist, commentator, or observer divined any common denominator in them until the month was nearly up. Confronted with the naked truth, the people of North America did not at once recognize it. But certainly every one of them saw it or heard about it in living color stereo and 36-point type and 4-channel FM, in weekly news magazines and on documentary shows, in gossip columns and radio talk shows, in political cartoons and in comedians' routines. Zach and Jill strongly preferred to examine their results from a distance, and so they tended to be splashy. In St. John, New Brunswick, they hit an elderly and prominent judge who had more wrinkles than a William Goldman novel while he was sitting in open court on a controversial treason case. After an astonishing 27-minute monologue, the aged barrister died in a successful attempt to cover with the sidearm he had snatched from his bailiff the defendant's escape. Zach and Jill, sitting in the audience, were considerably startled, but they had to agree that only once had they seen a man die happier. The judge's dead face was as smooth as a baby's. In Montreal, in addition to the Reverend Schwartz, they managed to catch a conservative MP on his way into a TV studio and shake his hand. The program's producer turned out to have seen the old movie Network. He kept the politician on the air, physically knocking down the programming director when that became necessary. The MP had been, liberally dosed. After 45 minutes of emotional confession, he began specifically outlining the secret dreams he had had ever since he first took office. The really good programs he had constructed in his imagination but never dared speak aloud, knowing they could never be implemented in the real world of power blocks and interest groups. He went home that night a broken but resigned man, and woke up the next morning to confront a landslide of favorable response, an overwhelming mandate to implement his dreams. To be sure, very, very few of the people who had voted for him in the last election ever did so again. But in the next election, and every subsequent election involving him, the 90% of the electorate who traditionally never vote turned out almost to a person. The producer is now his chief aide. In Ottawa, they tried for the prime minister, but they could not get near him or near anything that could get near him. But they did get the aging Peter Zosky on 90 Minutes Live. He, too, chanced to have seen Network, and he had much more survival instinct than its protagonist. The first thing he did upon leaving the studio was to make an extensive tape recording and mail several dubs thereof to friends with instructions for their disposal in the event of his sudden death. Accordingly, he is still alive and broadcasting today, and there are very few lids left for him to tear off these days. Outside Toronto, Zach and Jill made their single most spectacular raid at the Universal Light and Truth Convocation. It was a kind of week-long spiritual Olympics. Over a dozen famous gurus, swamis, reverends, zen masters, sufis, priests, priestesses, and assorted spiritual teachers had gathered with thousands of their followers on a donated 100-acre pasture to debate theology and sell each other incense with full media coverage. Zach and Jill walked through the showdown of the shaman, and between them missed not a one. One committed suicide. One went mad. 4 denounced themselves to their followers and fled. 7 denounced themselves to their followers and stayed. 4 wept too hard to speak. The one the others called the fat boy, though he was middle-aged, bit off his tongue, and exactly 1 teacher, the old man who had brought few followers and nothing for sale, exhibited no change whatsoever in his manner or behavior, but went home very thoughtfully to Tennessee. It is now known that he could have blown the story then and there, for he was a telepath, but he chose not to. The single suicide bothered Jill deeply, but only because she happened to know of and blackly despised that particular holy man, and was dismayed by the pleasure she felt at his death. But Zach challenged her to name 1 way in which his demise either diminished the world or personally benefited her, and she came tentatively to accept that her pleasure might be legitimate. They happened to arrive in Detroit just before the annual meeting of the Board of Directors of General Motors. Madam President absent-mindedly pocketed the cigar she found in the back seat of her Rolls that morning, though it was not her brand, and it had been saturated with enough odorless, tasteless TWT to dose Madison Square Garden. It is, of course, impossible to ever know exactly what transpired that day in that most sacrosanct and guarded and unpublic of rooms, but we have the text of the press release that ensued, and we do know that all GM products subsequent to 1994 burn alcohol instead of gasoline and exhibit a sharp upward curve in safety and reliability. In Chicago, Zach and Jill got a prominent and wealthy realtor-developer and all his tame engineers, ecologists, lawyers, and other promotion experts in the middle of a public debate over a massive rezoning proposal. There are no more slums in Chicago, and the developer is, of course, its present mayor. In Cleveland, they got a used car salesman, a TV repairman, a plumber, an auto mechanic, and a doctor of philosophy in one glorious afternoon. In New York, they got Matu Zanje, quite by accident. The renegade white led a force of 16 new Black Panthers in a smash-and-grab raid on the downtown club where Zach and Jill were playing. Matu Zanje personally took Jill's purse and smoked a cigar which he found therein on his way back uptown. Zach and Jill never learned of his death or their role in it, but it is doubtful that they would have mourned. In Boston, they concentrated on policemen, as many as they could reach in two mornings and afternoons, and by the time they left that town, it was rocking on its metaphorical foundations. Interesting things kept boiling up out of the cracks, and most of them have since decomposed in the presence of air and sunlight. In Portland, Maine, Zach figured a way to plant a timed-release canister in the air conditioning system of that city's largest welfare center. A great many people voluntarily left the welfare roll over the ensuing month, and none have yet returned or starved. There are, of course, a lot of unemployed caseworkers. And then they were on their way home to Halifax. But this is a listing only of the headlines that Zach and Jill left behind them, not of everything that happened on that trip. Not even of everything important, at least not to Zach and Jill. In Quebec, a laundry van just missed killing them both, then roared away. In Ottawa, they went out for a late-night walk just before a tremendous explosion partially destroyed their motel. It had apparently originated in the room next to theirs, which was unoccupied. In Toronto, they were attacked on the streets by what might have been a pair of honest muggers, but by then they were going armed and they got one apiece. In Detroit, the driver of the cab they had taken, at ruinous expense, to eliminate a suspected tail, apparently went mad and deliberately jumped a divider into high-speed oncoming traffic. In any car crash, the law of chaos prevails, and in this instance it killed the driver and left Zach and Jill bruised and shaken, but otherwise unharmed. They knew enemy action when they saw it, and so they did the most confusing thing they could think of. Stopped showing up for their scheduled gigs, but kept on following the itinerary. They also adopted reasonably ingenious disguises, and with some trepidation, stopped traveling together. Apparently the combination worked. They were not molested again until they showed up for the New York gig to break the pattern, and then only by Matu Zanje, which they agreed was coincidence. But it made them thoughtful, and they rented several hours of complete privacy in a videotape studio before leaving town. And on the road to Boston, they each combed their memory for friends remembered as one of the nice ones, people they could trust. And in that city, they met in the Tremont Street post office and spent an hour addressing and mailing vidcassette mailer packs. Each pack contained within it, in addition to its program material, a 20-second trailer holding 500 hits of TWT in blotter form, a smuggling innovation of which Zach was sinfully proud. They had not yet taken TWT themselves, but their decision was made. They agreed at the end of that day to take it together when they got back to Halifax. They would do it in the Scorpio, alone together, in the dressing room where Wesley George had died. They waited until well after closing, after Finnegan and the Shadow had locked up behind them and driven away the last two cars in the parking lot. Then they waited another hour to be sure. The night was chill and still, save for the occasional distant street sounds from more active parts of town. There was no moon, and the sky was lightly overcast. Darkness was total. They waited in the black together, waiting not for any particular event or signal, but only until it felt right, and they both knew that time without words. They were more married already than most couples get to be in a lifetime, and they were no longer in any hurry at all. When it was time, they rose from their cramped positions behind the building's trash compactor and walked stealthily around to the front of the building, to the descending stairway that led to the outer door of the dressing room. Like all of Finnegan's regulars, they knew how to slip its lock, and did so with minimal noise. As soon as the door clicked shut behind them, Jill heaved a great sigh compounded of relief and fatigue and déjà vu.
"This is where it all started," she breathed. "The tour is over. Full circle."
Zack looked around at pitch blackness. "From the smell in here, I would guess it was Starship Earth played here tonight." Jill giggled. "Still living on soybeans, too. Zack, can we put the light on, do you think?" "No windows, but this door isn't really tight. I don't think it'd be smart on." "How about a candle?" "Sold. Let me see. Ouch! If the starship left a... Yeah, here's a couple." He struck the light and started both candles. The room sprang into being around them as though painted at once in broad strokes of butter and chocolate. It was, after a solid month of perpetually new surroundings, breathtakingly familiar and comfortable. It lifted their hearts, even though both found their eyes going at once to the spot on which Wesley George had fallen.
"If your ghost is here, Wesley, rest easy, man," Zack said quietly.
"It got covered, and we're both back to do truth ourselves. They killed you, man, but they didn't stop you."
After a pause, Jill said,
"Thank you, Wesley," just as quietly. Then she turned to Zack. "You know, I don't even feel like we need to take the stuff in a place."
"I know, hon, I know. We've been more and more honest with each other, opened up more every day, like the truth was going to come sooner or later, so we might as well get straight now. I guess I know you better than I've ever known any human, let alone any woman. But if fair is fair and right is right, we've got to take the stuff. I wouldn't have the balls not to."
"Sure. Come on. Wesley's waiting." Together they walked hand in hand past the cigar burn and the rug to Wesley's dying place. The whisper of their boots on the rug echoed oddly in the soundproof room, then faded to silence.
"The door was open that night," Jill whispered.
"Yeah," Zack agreed. He turned the knob, eased the door open, and yelped in surprise and fright. A bulky figure sat on the stage 10 feet away, half propped against an amp, ankles crossed before it. It was in deep shadow, but Zack would have known that silhouette in a coal cellar. He pushed the door open wider, and the candlelight fell on the figure, confirming his guess.
"Finnegan!" he cried in relief and astonishment. "Jesus Christ, man, you scared me. I swear I saw you leave an hour ago."
"Nope," said the barkeep.
He was of medium height and stocky, bald as a grape, but with fuzzy brown hair all over his face and neck. It was the kind of face within which the unbroken nose was incongruous. He scratched his crinkly chin with a left hand multiply calloused from 20 years of guitar and dobro and mandolin and fiddle, and grinned what his dentist referred to as the $1,000 grin.
"You just thought you did."
"Well, shit, yeah, so it seems. Look, we're just sort of into a little head thing, if that's cool. I meant to tell you later."
"Sure."
A noise came from behind Zack, and he turned quickly to Jill. "Look, baby, it's Finn." Jill had not made the noise, nor did she make one now. Ziller had made the noise as he slipped the lock on the outside door, and he made another one as he snapped the hammer back on the silenced Colt. It echoed in the dressing room. Zack spun back to Finnegan, and the barkeep's right hand was up out of his lap now, and there was a .357 Magnum in it.
"Too tired," Zack thought wearily. "Too friggin' tired. I wasn't cautious enough, and so it ends here."
"I'm sorry, Jill," he said aloud, still facing Finnegan. "I," Finnegan said clearly and precisely, "am a bi-federal agent authorized to act in either the American or the Canadian sector. Narcotics has been my main turf for years now."
"Sure," Zack agreed. "What better cover for a narc than a musician?"
"This one," Finnegan said complacently. "I always hated being on the road. Halifax has always been a smuggler's port. Why not just sit here and let the stuff come to me? All the beer I can drink."
Ziller was going through the knapsack Jill had left by the door without taking his eyes or his gun off them for an instant. So how come you're in bed with Ziller?
Zack demanded.
Ziller looked up and grinned, arraying his massive beard like a peacock's tail.
Well, George blew my cover, Finnegan said cheerfully. He knew me from back when and spilled the soybeans. If he'd known you two were regulars here, he'd likely have warned you. So after Ziller did him in and then found out he had not adequately secured the goods, he naturally came straight to me.
Finnegan's got a better organization than we do, Ziller chuckled.
His voice was like a lizard's with sound if lizards could talk.
More manpower, more resources, more protection.
And Ziller knew the TWT would mean the end of me, too, if it got out. He figured that our interests coincided for once. In a world of truth, what use is a narc? How can he work?
Much too goddamn tired, Zack told himself. I'm hallucinating.
Finnegan appeared to be winking at him. Zack glanced to see if Jill were reacting to it, but her eyes were locked on Ziller, whose eyes were locked on her. Zack glanced swiftly back, and Finnegan still appeared to be winking, and now he was waving Zack toward him. Zack stood still. He preferred to die in the dressing room.
He took a gamble, Finnegan went on, a gamble that I would go just as far as he would go to see that drug destroyed. Well, we missed you in Quebec and Ottawa and Toronto, and you fooled us when you went to Portland instead of your gig in Bangor, but I guess we've got you now.
You're wrong, Jill said, turning to glare at Finnegan. It's too late. You're both too late. You can kill us, but you can never recall the truth now.
People forget headlines, Ziller sneered confidently. Even a month of headlines. Nothing.
You're still wrong, Zack said, staring in confusion from Ziller to Jill to the gesticulating Finnegan. We put about 30 tapes and TWT samples in the mail.
Jerks, Ziller said, shaking his head. Outthought every step of the way. Look, Sonny, if you want to move a lot of dope with minimum risk, where do you get a job?
He paused and grinned again.
The post office, dummy.
No, Zack and Jill said together, and Finnegan barked,
yes,
quite sharply. They both turned to look at him. You can bug any room with a window in it, children, he said wearily, and that dressing room, of course, has always been bugged.
Oh, look, damn it.
He held up a vidcassette mailer pack with broken seals, and at last they both started forward involuntarily toward it, and as he cleared the dressing room doorway, Zack finally caught on, and he reached behind him, and an incredible thing happened. It must be borne in mind that both Zack and Jill had, as they had earlier recognized, been steadily raising the truth level between them for over a month, unconsciously attempting to soften the blow of their first TWT experience. The Tennessee preacher, earlier noted, had once said publicly that all people are born potentially telepathic, but that if we're ever going to get any message traffic capacity, we must first shovel the shit out of the communications room. This room, he said, was called by some the subconscious mind. Zack and Jill had almost certainly been exposed to at least threshold contamination with TWT, and they were, as it happens, the first subjects to be a couple and very much in love. They had lived together through a month that could have killed them at any time, and they were already beginning to display minor telepathic rapport. Whatever the reasons, for one fractionated instant their hands touched glancingly, and Jill, who had seen none of Finnegan's winking and almost nothing of his urgent gestures, knew all at once exactly what was about to happen and what to do, and Zack knew that she knew and that he didn't have to worry about her. Ziller was close behind them. There was no time even for one last flicker glance at each other. They grinned and winked together at Finnegan, and Zack dove left and Jill drove right, and Ziller came into the door with the Colt extended, wondering why Finnegan hadn't fired already, and there was just time for his face to register. Of course he has no silencer, before Finnegan shot him. A .357 Magnum throwing a 120-grain Supervel hollow point can kill you if it hits you in the foot, from hydrostatic shock to the brain. Ziller took it in the solar plexus and slammed back into the dressing room to land with a wet, meaty thud. The echoes roared and crackled away like the treble thunder that comes sometimes with heat lightning.
"I'm kind of more than your garden-variety narc," Finnegan said calmly. "Maybe you guessed."
Yes, Jill said for both of them, a few seconds ago. To arrange that many convincingly bungled hits, you've got to be big. You took a big chance with that cab driver.
Oh, hell, he wasn't mine. That guy just happened to flip. Happens all the time.
I believe you, she said, again for the two of them.
People will have heard that shot, Zack suggested diffidently.
Nobody who wasn't expecting it, son, Finnegan said, and sighed. Nobody who wasn't expecting it.
Zack nodded.
Question?
Sure.
How come you're still holding that gun? because both of you still have yours, the government said softly. No one moved for a long, frozen moment. Zack was caught with his right hand under him, and attempting to conceal the gun, he had lost the use of it. Jill's was behind a crouching leg, but she left it there. "We don't figure you, Ed," she said softly. "That's all. You see that, don't you?" "Of course," he said. "So lighten up on the iron, and by and by we'll all go get ham and eggs at my place. I'll teach you that song about Bad Eye Bill and the Eskimo Gal." "You're not relaxing is worth a shit, Finnegan," Zack grated. "Talk. How big are you?" Finnegan pursed his lips, blew a tiny bubble between them. "Big. Bigger than narcotics. Bifederality leaves a lot of gaps. I guess you could say I'm the man, Zachar, old son. For our purposes, anyway. Oh, I have superiors, including the President and the Prime Minister. I am so clever and nimble, none of them is even afraid of me. I think the PM rather likes me. It's important that you know how heavy I am. It'll help you believe the rest." He paused there, and Zach said, "Try us," in a gentler tone of voice. Finnegan looked around him at the darkened music room, at shadowy formica toadstool tables bristling with chair legs, at the great hovering buzzard blot that was the high spotlight, at a stage full of amplifiers and a piano like stolid dwarves and a troll come to sit in judgment on him, at the mocking red glow of the sign over the door that claimed it was an exit. He took a deep breath and spoke very carefully. "Did you ever wonder why a man takes on a job like mine?" He wet his lips. "He takes it on because it's a job that somebody has to do, and he sees that the man doing it is a bloody, bungling butcher playing James Bond with the fate of the world. Can you see that? I hated his job as much as I hated him, but I understood that in a world like this, when someone has to do that job, somebody just plain has to do that job, and I decided that no one in sight could do a better job than me. So I forced him to retire, and I took his job. It is a filthy pig fucker of a job, and it has damaged me to do it, but somebody had to. I have done things that horrified me, things that diminished me, but I did good things, too, and I have been striving every minute toward a world in which my job didn't exist, in which nobody had to shoulder that load. I've been working to put myself out of a job without the faintest shred of hope for over 10 years, and now it's Christmas and I'm free, I'm fucking free. That makes me so happy I could go down to the cemetery and dig up Wes and kiss him on the moldy lips. So happy I'll feel just terrible if I can't talk you two out of killing me. My job is finished now. Nobody knows it but you and me, but it's all over but the shouting. And in gratitude to you and Wes, I intend to use my last gasp of power and influence to try to keep you two alive when the shit hits the fan." "Huh? I kind of liked your idea, so I let your vidcassette packs go through. But first, I erased them and re-recorded. Audio only. Voice out of a voter. Nothing identifying you two. That won't fool a computer for long, but they're all friends of yours, and it buys us time."
"For what?" Jill asked.
"Time to get you two underground, of course. How would you like to be, oh, say, a writer and her husband in Colorado for 6 months or so? You look good as a blonde."
"Finnegan," Zach said with great weariness, "this all has a certain compelling inner consistency to it, but you surely understand our position. Unless you can prove any of this, we're going to have to shoot it out."
"Why, you damn fools," Finnegan blazed. "What are you wasting time for? You've got some of the stuff with you. Give me a taste."
There was a pause while the pair thought that over.
"How do we do this?" Jill asked at last.
"Put your guns on me," Finnegan said. They stared.
"Come on, damn it, for now that's the only way we can trust each other. Just like the world out there, guns at each other's heads because we fear lies and treachery, the sneak attack. Put your fucking guns on me, and in an hour that world will be on its way out. Come on!" he roared.
Hesitantly, the two brought up their guns until all three weapons threatened life. Jill's other hand brought a tiny stoppered vial from her pants. Slowly, carefully, she advanced toward Finnegan, holding out the truth. And when she was 3 feet away, she saw Finnegan grin and heard Zack chuckle, and then she was giggling helplessly at the thought of three solemn faces above pistol sights, and all at once, all three of them were convulsed with great racking whoops of laughter at themselves, and they threw away their guns as one. They held their sides and roared with laughter until all three had fallen to the floor, and then they pounded weakly on the floor and laughed some more. There was a pause for panting and catching of breath, and a few tapering giggles, and then Jill unstoppered the vial and upended it against each proffered fingertip and her own. Each licked their finger eagerly, and from about that time on, everything began to be all right. Literally. An ending is the beginning of something. Always.
Now here's James Taylor with a kick-ass band in Atlanta, Georgia, 1981, just 2 years after Satan's Children first saw print, talking about a machine that began malfunctioning when Bush II took office and is barely running today.
See, when I was just a child, my life was oh so simple. Ways of the great world seem strange and foreign. Then when I was a young man, well, I learned of that machine. Wait a minute, it turns out all those bays of precious
To mellow us out some before I leave you, here's a track that's one of many reasons why it's worth however many attempts it will take you to register at www.dimeadozen.org. A recording so wonderful and historic and rare I can scarcely believe it exists or that I have a copy of it to share with you. Climb in my time machine and travel back with me another 22 years to 1959 to a little jazz festival in a Rhode Island hamlet called Newport, where the hottest vocal group in jazz history, Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross, joined forces on stage with the great Joe Williams for one of his signature tunes, backed by the immortal Count Basie and his orchestra. This starts out as an obscure old song called Taps Miller, but soon morphs into the classic, Every Day I Have the Blues.
Cats turn to open, taps he start to open, dance from day to early dawn. You never did see such goings on. I never had such a baritone. He really knows how the feeling goes. I never had such a crazy treat till the time when Tap was dancing. Just to see him tapping, as you finger snapping, graceful as a baby fawn. You never did see such goings on. Taps Miller working. Someone should be good, whether dancing or prancing.
Sugar
and
pizza ball.
Taps don't play around, whether he's up, whether he's down. People fight. You dig the dance, you're ready to try it.
Any kind of rhythm you can name. Any kind of dancer with a claim to fame. Any kind of tune, whether old or late. Well, Taps got a time of the same.
Great. It's hard to move you. Taps is sure to groove you. Finds a beat and lets it spawn. You never did see such going on. Taps, taps, he's that baby doing the show. Taps, taps, he looks tip-top, tapping the toe. But for tapping, look out, there ain't nothing better to see. Tapping,
she was deep. One, two, three. The other acts that follow him on, they know that type of way. No sense in lying, he puts down some iron. Tapped his toe when he was born. You never did see such going on. I know, perhaps anybody beaten for he can dance.
What can I do?
See me worry, baby.
I've had a few.
Because it's you I hate to lose.
What about settling? How are you gonna keep me from meddling?
Nobody loves me.
Whoa.
Nobody seems to care.
Baby, don't seem to care. Her loving cupboard is bare.
Nobody loves me. Nobody seems to care.
How are you gonna get her to care? Gotta be a millionaire.
Speaking of bad luck and trouble.
Luck and trouble.
Well, you know I've had my share.
Yeah, man, I'm digging, you tell me.
Gonna pack my suitcase.
Moving,
moving on
moving
down the line.
The blues are down, down.
So now you might as well split. Seems to me every day
I hear them talking.
Every day
they got me talking.
I have to do
and have me say. Yeah.
Every day
they got me crying.
Every day
he's really crying.
I have to do
really not this way.
Yeah. See me worry, baby, because it's you I hate to lose.
He's bound to lose a Sunday.
Nobody loves me. Nobody seems to care.
No one to love.
Nobody loves me. Nobody seems to care.
No one to love.
Speaking of bad luck and trouble.
I
have to
hear him singing the song.
clear.
Every day.
His blues are doing him all. Just wait. He'll sing and shout him away. Too late.
Every
looks
day.
Like they're coming to stay. That's fate.
Worry, baby.
Please chase contentment
cause
away.
It's you.
Just lay
it I hate to lose.
On
every day.
Yes, indeed. Before I go, I want to thank all of you who have been sending me and Jeannie moving and heartwarming and strength-giving email at spiderweb@shaw.ca these days. It helps. A lot. And both of us appreciate it more than I can say. Jeannie and I continue to try to make the most of each minute of every day, and some of our happier minutes are spent reading your emails to each other. Thanks also to those who have expressed your support in the form of PayPal donations to http://www.wedreamforgenie.blogspot.com. wedreamforgenie.blogspot.com. Even in a country with health care, battling cancer is goddamn expensive. I'd just like to report to all of you that my Jeannie continues to endure chemotherapy with a courage, grace, dignity and calm I could never muster in her place. I've admired and respected her for 35 years, but never more than this year. Finally, your subscriptions and or donations to this podcast are also most gratefully received. It ain't making me any serious bank, but thanks to your support, at least so far I can keep the pilot light lit. And turning you on to good SF and good music is some of the most fun I have. Okay, Doug Cox opened this podcast with his friends Salil, Ram Komesh, and Johnny. Here he is again to close it with another mutual friend of ours, the legendary Amos Garrett of Turner Valley, Alberta. Dig Doug and Amos as they channel the two Louis, Armstrong and Jordan, in a remake of their classic duet, Life is So Peculiar, the title track of one of Doug's very finest albums. Take it, boys.
Vop-a-dee-voop-dee-vop-dee-zed. Life is so peculiar.
You get so wet in the rain.
In British Columbia, you get so warm in the sunshine.
Oh yeah, you got that Alberta tan.
It doesn't pay to complain.
I'm not grumbling. When I get up each morning, there's nothing to breathe but air.
Yeah, when I look in the mirror, there's nothing to comb but hair.
You're lucky. When I sit down to breakfast, there's nothing to eat but food. Life is so peculiar, but you can't stay home and brood. Whoa, life.
Tell me about it, Amos.
It's so peculiar. The desert's only got sand.
And that's grand.
The ocean's only got water.
Yeah, you can't drink it all up.
You never know where you stand.
When I go out to dinner, there's nothing to wear but clothes. Whenever I get sleepy, there's nothing to do but doze.
Oh, yes.
Whenever I get thirsty, well, Amos, you know that I like to drink.
I heard that. Life is so peculiar that it makes you stop and think. Yes, life,
Father, do whatever
you want. It's so peculiar.
It sure is.
A fork belongs with a knife.
It sure does. Corned beef is lost without cabbage.
I love cabbage. A husband should have a wife. Yes, life is so peculiar, but as everybody says, that's life.
There's always that guitar.
Oh, Dougie, why don't you have a little here? Give me that thing.
That's nice.
Oh, I like it.
so peculiar.
Sure is.
A bird can usually sing.
Not around me.
Carnivore. A pearl is made by an oyster.
New Orleans.
Rampart Street. You can't be sure of things.
When I get tired of resting, there's nothing to do but walk.
I walk and walk.
When I don't care to listen, there's nothing to do but talk.
Keep your big mouth shut.
When I'm up in an airplane, there's nothing to do but fly.
Mm-hmm.
Life is so peculiar, but I often wonder why. Whoa, life.
Father, do ever why?
Is so peculiar.
Sure is.
A fork belongs with a knife.
Definitely.
Yes.
Corned beef is lost without cabbage.
You lost the cabbage. A husband should have a wife. Yes, life is so peculiar, but as everybody says, that's life.
One more, Ron.
That's life.
How about you, mate?
That's life.
Hand it over, Phil.
That's life.
And that's Spider on the Web number 80. Please come back in a couple of weeks and join us for an all-music podcast. And in the meantime, don't forget Better Bookstores Everywhere. I still have a few copies of my latest novel, Very Hard Choices, available for sale. I'm Spider Robinson, and I thank you for the gift of your attention.